Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. I remember when I was a kid in high school. One day, me and a buddy were out riding bikes. We came to the river in my hometown, and in a flash, we decided to swim across it. Never mind that it was a busy Sunday afternoon with lots of boats moving up and down the St. Croix, or that I wasn't the world's greatest swimmer, or that we had just completed a long bike ride. We made it, but I remember the return leg of the trip, and I was really tired and had to wave at a few boaters to make sure they didn't run over me. What I needed that day was a voice of reason talking in my head saying, "Don't do it, kid. Use a little common sense." That's what our show is about today, injecting common sense into our lives as we ease toward the big 4th of July weekend. We're going to run through some of the basics today when it comes to safety in the water, under the water, on a boat, or under the sun. We'll begin with being smart in the sun. And with us today is dermatologist Dr. Jules Lipoff. He's an assistant professor of clinical dermatology at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. Lipoff, so good to have you. Good morning, Jules.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, I've read about the need for sunscreen that's labeled broad-spectrum sunscreen. What is that exactly?
So what broad spectrum means is that it's a sunscreen that blocks both ultraviolet A, or UVA, and ultraviolet B, or UVB light.
Wow.
This is part of light that is invisible, but that can have harm.
And what's the difference between UVA versus UVB? How are those rays different, Jules?
So it's basically a different wavelength of light, but basically sunlight has these two types of ultraviolet rays that can reach the Earth's surface, and both UVA and UVB. And we think that both of these types can lead to skin cancer. So since the UVA actually has a deeper, a longer wavelength, it can go deeper into your skin. Now, sunburn is primarily caused by UVB light, but both types of the rays can cause premature aging and ultimately lead to skin cancer.
So broad-spectrum sunscreen then deals with both UVA and UVB.
That's right. So previously, sunscreens really primarily blocked just UVB because it was felt that that was the main cause of skin cancers. But now we believe that UVA also confers a big risk. So that's been the big push to make sure that both types of rays are covered.
I gotcha. Tell me about labeling guidelines on, you know, a container of sunscreen. How new are they? How new are the guidelines that govern what I read when I pick up a bottle of sunscreen?
So in 2012, the FDA established some new guidelines, and first and foremost, they just standardized the way we test how effective they are, and they made some other propositions. First, they recommended that we not sell any sunscreen with an SPF greater than 50, because or at least it would be labeled as 50+, since there hasn't really been evidence to show that that adds any benefit.
Mm.
They also banned, the use of some labels that were considered misleading, such as waterproof or sweatproof.
Ah.
And basically, all sunscreens will wear off eventually.
I used to wonder about that when I picked up that stuff.
Yeah.
So you also come across these SPF numbers, Jules. What does SPF stand for, and what am I looking for there?
So SPF stands for skin protection factor, and it only has to do with how much protection that you would get against UVB rays. So what we're looking for is a specific number that marks, you know, how much protection you have. And the FDA recently said if they sell it for under 15, they have to explicitly state on the package, does not protect against skin cancer.
Hmm. So what am I looking for exactly? What level of protection do you need, and how much does it depend on how naturally dark one's skin is anyway?
So, you know, the American Academy of Dermatology, or the AAD, recommends using a sunscreen of at least SPF 30. And that's what I recommend to my patients. I think that, a lot of moisturizers that patients use have even SPF 15 in them. And, you know, I just don't think that's good enough. I think it gives you a certain sense of comfort. But really, you need a separate sunscreen with SPF 30. And you need to be reapplying that, especially if you're going to be in the sun.
Reapplying how often? I know it depends whether you get in the water or not, but what do you recommend on that score?
So So we generally say you should apply every 2 hours, and initially you should apply 10 to 15 minutes before you even get outside.
And why is it important to apply it before you go outside?
Well, it doesn't necessarily fully get absorbed or take effect immediately, so it just takes a little bit of time.
So everyone, you're saying, regardless of skin tone, skin color, you're saying an SPF of at least 30.
So, I mean, you're driving an important point that we're not all created equal with our susceptibility. People with darker skin are much less likely to have sun aging and skin cancers. If you're African American, you may not age as quickly, and your risk for sunburn may be lower. But anyone is at risk for skin cancer. So if you're going to be actively outside in the sun, it's my recommendation.
We're talking about sunscreen and all the different factors that govern how much you should apply, when you should apply it. We're visiting with a dermatologist, Dr. Jules Lipoff, who's an assistant professor of clinical dermatology at the University of Pennsylvania. If you want to join our conversation with a question for Dr. Lipoff about sunscreens, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You know, Jules, I've always read that the hours between 10 and 2 are the potentially most damaging hours when the sun can do the most harm. Am I seeing that right? Am I hearing that right?
That's generally what we say, and so we recommend, you know, trying to avoid the sun during those hours. You know, we're talking about sunscreen, and that is, you know, very important that we emphasize the use of that, but we don't want to lose in this that the most important thing is just sun avoidance in general. And so when it's strongest rays are in the middle of the day, you'd like to avoid it. You want to be trying to wear more sun-protective clothing, like wide-brim hats, longer sleeves as possible, staying in the shade, that sort of thing.
Do you think, you know, we've been hearing this kind of talk from good folks like you for a number of years now. To what extent do you think Americans and people are becoming more aware of this danger and responding to it appropriately?
Well, I certainly think we've come a long way since the days when people were regularly baking themselves in the sun with baby oil. And I think, you know, people are very conscious about the need for protection, but I think they're still pretty confused about what the best and right protection is. And I think often most people nowadays only use sunscreen when they go out to the beach or the pool. But in truth, the sun is always out there, and it's a cumulative effect over your lifetime.
And it's safe to say for those of us who are old of a certain age that the sun is more dangerous today, Jules, than it was 20, 25 years ago.
Well, I think that's I wouldn't say that outright, but certainly with all the talk about degradation to the ozone layer,
yeah,
and other things, it is worse. In particular, say in Australia, there is a very high rate of skin cancer and melanoma, and that's probably attributable to the poor ozone protection there. Because there is actually another type of light, ultraviolet C, that usually does not even get down to the surface because of the protection of the ozone layer.
Hmm. You know, should people use sunscreen, you know, even when it's cold outside?
So I would recommend that, you know, you have to use your best judgment, and it's not necessarily for everyone, but you get sun every day of your life, even if it's cloudy, 80% of the ultraviolet light gets through. And, you know, it may be strongest on those hot summer days with a bright sun, but it's cumulative. So even if you're middle-aged or older, there's still a lot of benefit to be wearing it every day. You shouldn't say, oh, I got all those burns when I was young. It's too late. But it's, you know, it's definitely something you should be doing.
Can you get sunburned by just driving in the car?
So you can't get sunburn from driving in the car, but you can get sun damage and sun aging and risk for skin cancer. And the reason is ultraviolet A light actually can get through glass.
Huh. So why can't you get sunburn then?
So it's basically a difference between UVB and UVA. UVB doesn't go as deep into the skin and has that effect, and UVA goes deeper. I mean, UVA does have that risk, and it is still complicated, and we don't completely understand how each of them exactly causes the skin cancers. But our understanding is that UVA is just penetrating deeper into the skin.
You know, maybe a good thing to ask at this point, Dr. Lipoff, is this notion that we're talking here about the dangers of sunburn and everything else. Ultimately, the concern is skin cancer. Just how dangerous is skin cancer? How treatable is it? How deadly can it be?
So there are many different kinds of skin cancers. First, I think we could just separate them a little bit. I like to simplify it and think of it as two main groups. There are the pink ones and the brown ones. So the most common skin cancers are the pink ones, and they're called basal cell carcinomas
Sure. And
squamous cell carcinomas. So these are usually not life-threatening, and if discovered, they usually just have to be cut out, and that's usually enough.
Bill Clinton had a basal cell cancer at one point in his life, I think.
I'm sure he did. You know, skin cancers are actually the most common cause of cancer in America, and they say that 1 in 5 Americans will get a skin cancer in their lifetime.
Wow. Okay. And then the brown ones are the more dangerous ones?
Yeah, the brown ones are more worrisome. So that includes the most concerning type of skin cancer, which is melanoma. That can develop spontaneously, or it can be in association with an existing mole. So the danger there is that it can metastasize to lymph nodes, internal organs. So, you know, early detection is really important. And we're fortunate that the skin is so visible and you don't need any further fancy test beyond a full skin exam by a dermatologist to detect it.
You know, some people are determined to get a tan. You know, is natural sun better than a tanning bed, or are they both bad, Jules?
So they're definitely both bad. So it doesn't really matter how you get it. It's still a harmful toxin. So actually, the Department of Health and Human Services, among others, have labeled ultraviolet radiation as a carcinogen. Whether it's from the sun or tan booth, it doesn't matter. So, you know, I think a good analogy is to cigarettes and lung cancer. You know, as a doctor, I can't condone anyone smoking even a single cigarette. And similarly, I can't say that any amount of tanning is okay. You know, you don't want to end up looking like you were on the Jersey Shore television show.
Lots of people claim they're minimizing the damage associated with sunburns by getting something called a base tan. At least I used to think this. Is that a myth, or does it really help protect you in the long run?
So it's a myth. Basically, like I said before, no amount of tanning is okay. So it is true, like I was saying, with African Americans and people with darker pigmentation, that will protect you against aging and skin cancer. But it defeats the purpose if you have to get sun exposure and DNA damage in order to earn that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're born with darker skin, you're lucky, but there's no cheating your genetics to get that pigmentation without harm.
So what do you recommend to folks like me who grew up in an era when you'd swim for a few hours and go lay on the dock for a while and sort of warm up and the sun beat down on you? We all went through our severe sunburns at one time or another. What should we be thinking about? What should we be doing about it?
So certainly if you are a high-risk person, and those are the people who often are very pale skin, burn very easily, maybe blue eyes, blonde, red hair, that sort of thing, you should probably consider just going to a dermatologist for a full skin check. And if you have, especially with melanomas, if you have a family history, like a first-degree relative, meaning your mom, your dad, your brother or sister who's had it, that's a good reason by itself to get a yearly skin check.
You know, you're saying that I shouldn't try to get a tan, but what if I have a desire to look like Fabio, you know, at some point this summer? Okay. Are there fake tanning options that are safe but also wind up looking pretty good?
Well, you know, it's perfectly safe to use the spray-on tans and self-tanners. I mean, it's up to your personal preference. The important thing is to remember that doesn't actually offer protection, so you need to continue to use sunscreen. And, you know, I know people like to look darker and have tans. I mean, I practice what I preach. I try to wear sunscreen every day, and I even have a T-shirt that says, "Pale is the new tan." So, you know, it's okay to be pale. It's okay. You don't have to get tan. I mean, if you want to, okay, I understand. But pale pale as the new tan.
Well, some folks might. I'm not sure everyone's going to buy that idea, Jules, but we'll let it go as it is. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Roger from Independence. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just wondering how much exposure do you need for vitamin D to generate the whatever you're needing for your life?
Ah, good question.
So, yeah, that's a very good question. So you do get most of your vitamin D from UVB exposure. But we, and this isn't without controversy, but in the field of dermatology, we feel that the healthiest way to get vitamin D would be through fortified foods and supplementation. Now, if you were to get it from the sun, you actually get all you need in a day in 10 minutes or less. And that's usually people are not on the beach for 10 minutes or less.
Yeah. Okay. So, but in the wintertime, what do you recommend then when sun exposure is minimized so much?
So I would recommend maybe wearing a daily sunscreen if you were of a higher risk, to maybe the face, the ears, the neck, the backs of the hands, just the exposed areas. And keeping in mind in the winter, especially when it's snowing or there's, that can reflect and actually give you a higher risk for sunburn, even though it's hot, as I think many skiers might tell you.
Okay. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Susan from Kansas City, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a comment. Both my father and my brother died of melanoma.
Mm.
My brother's melanoma was amelanomic, meaning it had no color, both spots. And at first, his dermatologist tested them and said, oh, no, they're okay. And he still had problems. Then when they went back and did a deeper biopsy, then they found the melanoma. I think people need to be aware that that little bump on the back of your hand that's no bigger than a BB and is skin-colored is still dangerous.
Hmm. Dr. Lipoff, go ahead.
So I think you bring up an excellent point. You know, the textbook melanoma is this dark, ugly-looking mole, but there are others that are not classic. And I would say, as a recommendation to people, you should be on the lookout for anything that's new, changing, rapidly growing, regardless of the color. I would rather that you come in to have a benign growth looked at than to let something go unexamined.
Okay. Valerie, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hello. Some clothing manufacturers promote products that claim to be SPF rated. Is that legitimate?
Oh, that's a great question. Jules?
Well, if there is an SPF listed, then it should be according to FDA guidelines, as far as I know.
Does that help, Valerie?
Basically, if you said a cosmetic, right?
No, clothing.
Clothing. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I misheard you.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jules. Yeah.
So they do sell, there are companies that sell this UV protection. Basically, SPF is just a factor, and it's a factor that measures how much sun is protected. So I'm going to have to assume that if they advertise that it's with the FDA's permission that it's been tested, but I'd have to look at a specific product or a specific thing to give you better information on that.
Sure. So if it is SPF rated, does that mean the government has to agree to that and accept it?
You know, I'm not that familiar with exact regulations, so I'm sorry.
All right. Valerie, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, we've had a few drownings in the area lately, including one Sunday at a pond at Kessler Park in northeast Kansas City. So it's time to inject that dose of common sense into our conversation that I mentioned in the opening. With us now to talk about swimming and boating safety is Kathy Edwards. She's a territory aquatic specialist with the American Red Cross. And Kathy, welcome. So good to have you.
Great to be here.
Okay, you're heading for the lake to the lake for a day of swimming with a family. What precautions should you take?
Well, the first thing is just let somebody know that you're going to go to the lake. So in case something does happen, people know that you're out there, and so just to be aware. The other one, please learn how to swim. That's so important.
And that means more than just a couple of lessons, I gather, in most cases.
Right. We we as the Red Cross has come out even with a more or less a competency type of test that somebody could take to see if they're even competent to be into a pool area. It's not for open water, but it is for the swimming pool. And basically, it's just to be able to jump in, see if you can go in over your head, be able to swim to the surface, swim about 25 yards, be able to turn around, and then swim back and get out of the area without using a ladder.
And if you can't do that, then you'd recommend what?
Take swimming lessons, definitely.
Yeah. What are the most, you know, common dangers that folks might find in a lake, for instance? What's dangerous about a lake?
Well, one thing that people don't really realize, especially with the lakes around our area, is that, well, of course, you can see. You know, you can't see underneath the water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't see your hand in front of your face. So be aware of that. So whatever drops in or whatever, there's also other things underneath that water. It could be sticks. It could be logs. It could be debris. It could be weeds.
I hate weeds. I hate seaweed. Don't like them.
And you get caught up in that?
Yeah, yeah. And you get caught up in that, what, you can get tangled up and all kinds of things can happen.
You can. And basically, the one thing that you need to do is think so you don't sink.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, that means don't panic. You know, we all have a fear of drowning. But as we feel more confident in water, we push that kind of back. But when somebody falls into the water, what happens is sometimes we take that big gulp. Like when you turn on the faucet, you know, in the shower, and it's the cold water.
And you take a gulp, and you begin to think all kinds of bad things at that point then.
Right. Well, what happens is that they take a big gulp, there's no air. And that's what we call the sudden disappearance syndrome, per se. And the person may not come back up to the surface at all.
Hmm. You know, tell me about lake currents, Kathy, and how they can affect a swimmer. I mean, are there currents strong enough in lakes to mess with a swimmer? Because I know there are in the ocean and in rivers, for instance, but even in a lake?
There are currents in a lake, and it depends on the feed of that lake also.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a river that comes into that area, there might be some other outlets from different sources,
yeah,
in which there could be a current. And a lot of people don't realize how powerful water actually can be. If you're standing in a water that's just up to your ankles and it's only going 3 miles an hour and you're going, oh, wow, that's not very fast at all. You have 33 pounds of pressure against your ankles. And then you put slippery rocks in that, and it's easy to go down.
And that's why people in the ocean, for instance, when they just go in up to their knees, sometimes even that can be an issue if the riptide is really strong or whatever it is.
If there's just a wave, it just the pressure of that wave pushing against your legs can just, you know, knock you over.
Well, let's do this, Kathy. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here about the dangers in pools and in swimming. We'll talk about life jackets, dangers in pools. We'll talk about how to help a drowning person if that should happen to you sometime this weekend, and a whole bunch more. And by all means, I want to thank dermatologist Dr. Jules Lipoff, an assistant professor of clinical dermatology at the University of Pennsylvania, for joining us in our first segment today. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation, our discussion of Governor Sam Brownback's electoral woes and recent LGBT events in Kansas and Missouri, you can find those at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we talk with a freelance writer about what war leaves behind, and we'll look at a report that lists the worst states for new parents. That's tomorrow on the show. This hour, we're trying to inject some common sense into all of our minds as we near the 4th of July weekend here. We're talking about swimming safety right now. We talked about sunscreen safety in our first half here. We're visiting with Kathy Edwards. She's a territory aquatic specialist with the American Red Cross. We were talking about the dangers of currents in even in lakes. What about the dangers of native wildlife? How often can that be an issue for swimmers even in lakes, Kathy?
Well, it's really interesting because even if a fish comes up to somebody and just kind of gives a little nibble, people panic. They jump. You know, it's just a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really have a lot of per se, aquatics life that's going to be a big danger. You do have to watch out for the snakes. There are copperheads and some water-type snakes that can probably give you a good bite, and you could get in trouble there.
What do you do if you see a snake coming at you?
Go the other way. No.
That's what I would do.
Basically, you know, if you splash water towards them, you know, they'll probably go the other way anyway.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's a good thing to do then if something like that's happening.
Yeah.
Anything else in the lake you might be need to keep an eye out for?
Well, the other part of that, again, in any type of water is look at your distances. People get into the water, they think they can swim to one side to the other, and they really can't judge, per se, the distance.
How far it is. Like I did that day in the river when I was a kid growing up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
It's very deceiving.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to watch out for what we call the terrible twos. You know, the water could be too cold also. There's a lot of places that are spring-fed, and that water is cold. Even when it's really hot outside, you can still get hypothermia.
Yeah. How about dangers in swimming pools?
Swimming pools, we recommend strongly that you swim where there's a lifeguard. That way you know that somebody's always watching. But believe it or not, most of the people think, oh, we can just go out and swim wherever we want to. May it be a backyard pool, may it be, apartment complex, some of the other, you know, neighborhood pools that may not have lifeguards. If that's the case, make sure that you have somebody watching and that they at least know some of the emergency procedures on how to prevent drowning. If somebody that you see looks like they're drowning, and that is very deceiving sometimes. It looks like the person's actually playing in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, somebody that's not a swimmer, there's no kick. And their arms actually flail up and down together, their heads back, and they don't make a sound.
So how do you know then if someone actually needs help? I mean, what are you looking? You're looking for those signs, and you should do what then?
Basically, you know, if you're not a lifeguard, definitely get help. Always get help. If you're the one right there and you're the one that has to react, you should do what we call a reach throw, but don't go type thing. You know, it's very easy. You have a towel. You have probably chairs. You have all sorts of different things that you can reach out with. Even your cooler can be pushed out or moved out to them where they can grab on.
But you want to use an object as opposed to your own hand?
It is always safer to use something between you and them. Even a lifeguard has the rescue tube between them and the rescuer, you know, the person you're rescuing.
And that's because why?
Basically, it's safer because you want something between you. The first thing that a person that's drowning is going to do is kind of panic, definitely, and they want air. And so they're going to climb up on anything they can to get that air. That's why a lot of parents don't realize that even a small child can drown an adult, because when they go in to save their child, basically the child's going to grab around their neck and push them down to reach up to get air.
That's what they're trying to do. Yeah,
I've
seen that before. Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Kathy from Kansas City, Missouri. Kathy, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Just listening to the last comment your guest made, don't swim with dogs because they can take you down and drown you too. They get panicky.
Ah.
My second comment is that, several years ago I was tube floating down the Salt River in Arizona. And we came upon a really nice little cove with a really nice glassy top, still water deep pool. I didn't know it was deep. I thought, well, this would be a nice place to kind of get off and swim around. Well, it was so deep that the current underneath was so strong it took me down. I'm a good swimmer, and I had to fight to get back up and fight to get back up onto my tube. So still waters do run deep. Don't get fooled.
Hey, how did you deal with the panic that might have come along at a time like that, Kathy?
Oh, I'm a good swimmer, and there were other people that were tubing with me, and I don't know, I just kept pushing hard to get back up to the top.
That's no fun, is it?
No, it's real scary.
Yeah, all right. Good comments, Kathy, I appreciate it. Thanks for calling. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Let's go to Mike from South Kansas City. Mike, good morning.
Hello. In my younger days, I still can. I considered myself a good swimmer.
But we'd go down to Lake of the Ozarks and other places like that. And I'd insist that the kids, and they knew how to swim to a certain level. But I insisted they have a life vest on. And when they're in the boats, you got to have everybody has the life vest on. It's not just in the boat. So, and I was thinking while I was waiting a moment, even if you're a good swimmer and you have a life vest and you're out there and somebody else gets in trouble and doesn't have a vest, you can help them, both of you, get back to back to a safe location. So anyways, it's common sense.
Yeah, that's sort of the key to all this.
It's like waiting till you see you're going to be in a wreck and then putting on your seatbelt.
That's a good point.
Do it up, and nobody thinks you look any less handsome.
Good comment, Mike. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Kathy, what are your thoughts about life jackets and who should use them?
Well, it's a federal law that you have one life jacket per person in the boat that fits them. Now, having them in the boat is one thing, but having them on is another, and we recommend strongly that they have them on. Usually when something happens, usually the life jacket's in one place and you are in another. So if you have it on, at least what will happen is that will help protect you. It will also keep you afloat, and it will be a device that you can help somebody else with also.
Mm-hmm. How much do those things cost?
Actually, it depends. You know, we have the real cheap ones, you know, the orange ones that look like a horseshoe.
I used to hate those things.
Everybody doesn't really like them. Little kids don't like them, but they always seem to be the ones that have to wear them.
Yeah. They're big. They're bulky. Yeah.
And you can get them really cheap. You can get them for $5 or less in some areas, maybe up to $10.
Mm-hmm.
The best one that most people will wear is what we call a Type 3, and that's a vest. The only problem with a vest is that if you are knocked unconscious in the water, it'll definitely keep you up to the surface.
But you might be face down. What about those floaties that little kids wear? How effective are those?
It's a device that's out there.
They're
not Coast Guard approved. They're not something that you want to have the child depend on. And what I mean by that is that they can deflate. They can be pulled off. The child can panic. They feel like they're caught in it, or all of a sudden they're depending on it and it's gone.
You know, what about kids who don't have much access to swim training that they need to have before they go in the water? How can they get access to that easily, Kathy? What do you advise there?
You know, there are swim lessons throughout the city, throughout the country. There's lots of programs that will have different types of programs that they can get into lessons free or have a free time for lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Just look around. But the main thing is to get into lessons, and that's really important.
Maybe just a final point here. If you're in a river or a creek, even this weekend when everyone's going to be out and the water's moving fast, how do you swim more safely through fast-moving water?
Well, if you get yourself caught into moving water, the best thing to do is to lay on your back and go feet first. It's a whole lot easier to bounce off with your feet than it is with your head, definitely. So if you can, you know, lay on your back. If you have your life jacket on, which we recommend strongly that anytime you're in the water, you can use your feet to bounce around the rock or the strainer or whatever. If you do come up in what I call a strainer where the water flows through it, the best thing to do is to get as high as you can on it and go over it. Don't try to go through it because you can get caught, and with that water pressure, it can hold you there.
And you're talking about a what getting caught where exactly?
It's called a strainer. That's like a tree that comes down and or grating across something. With the power of the water, with the pressure, it can hold you against it. And it sometimes takes a little bit much to try to get that power to get out of that type of situation.
Well, Kathy, you've been great. Thanks for taking some time. That's Kathy Edwards. She's a territory aquatic specialist with the American Red Cross, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Well, we think of scuba diving as taking place in tropical locales, but many people dive right here in area lakes. Unfortunately, even in these seemingly still waters, tragedy can strike, just as it did last month with the death of a diver at Table Rock Lake. Here to help us with scuba safety is Ken Curtis. He's the owner of Reef Seekers Dive Company in Beverly Hills, California. Since 2003, Ken has been a forensic consultant to the L.A. County Coroner for scuba fatalities, doing equipment testing and accident analysis. And Ken, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, what are the universal dangers of scuba diving, regardless of what type of water you're in, Ken?
Well, the biggest problem that any diver faces is loss of air. Diving in and of itself is statistically, at least, a pretty safe sport. There are relatively few accidents, let alone fatalities. But, you know, it is definitely a life-threatening environment, so there's really nothing more critical than watching your air supply, because if that should go away because you run out of air or there's some other problem, you basically got as long as you can hold your breath to fix the problem.
I was going to say, what's the most common mistake that scuba divers tend to make?
Well, it is running out of air. There's national studies that have been done with looking at fatalities over a 10-year period. And in the fatalities where we can identify what we call the trigger, what got things going, 47% of the time it's the diver running out of air. To give you the analogy, it's the equivalent of never looking at your gas gauge and running out of gas while you're, you know, in the middle of the highway or something like that.
Has it ever happened to you, Ken?
No, sir, and that's the proper answer for any diver. You should never run out of air.
And you know not to run out of air. What do you use to gauge how much air you got left?
Well, you've got a gauge that's hooked up through your regulator to your tank. So a typical scuba tank will have anywhere from, we measure it in pounds per square inch, PSI. So just like the gas gauge on your car, it's going to read, you know, full, half, quarter, empty, whatever it is. For instance, on most tanks, they start, let's say, at 3,000 PSI. And over the course of a dive, I should be checking my gauge every few minutes to see how much air I have left. And generally what we tell people is you want to surface with about 500 PSI at the end of your dive. That allows for any anomalies in the gauge or anything like that, or if anything, you know, should go wrong unexpected, you still have a little bit of air left.
You know, out here, unlike where you are, Ken, the most common place that folks tend to go scuba diving is in a lake. Are there hazards particular to lake diving that you might point to?
Well, there certainly are, and actually I originally got certified in Virginia and dove in a little quarry there called Gum Springs Quarry, so very typical to what you might have in Missouri. You know, in lakes and stuff like that, man-made or otherwise, you may have some underwater hazards. There may be trees, there may be other entanglements. Entanglement is always a big issue wherever we happen to be diving. But one big problem you have, too, is going to be generally in lakes, you're probably going to have less visibility than you might in the ocean or something like that. And, you know, I think everybody's aware from even when we were kids, the idea of the buddy system. You and I are going to stick together and look out for each other. And that's a very important thing in diving. But when you're in 10 foot of visibility, you and I are maybe going along shoulder to shoulder. I drift 5 feet to the right. You drift 6 feet to the left. We're now 11 feet apart. And if 10 foot is the visibility, we can't see each other. And unfortunately, things tend to happen in diving when the accidents happen. They many times happen out of sight of other people. So we don't always have an exact picture of what might have gone wrong. But, you know, based on what we can piece together from the evidence, we can get a pretty good idea.
What do you do if you lose touch with your partner in a situation that you just described, Ken? What's the proper procedure at that point?
Well, and the thing to emphasize is nothing has changed. So if everything was fine 2 seconds ago in terms of air and I feel good and everything else, nothing has gone different than other than, oops, I can't see you anymore. So what I would do, the standard procedure, is to search for about 1 minute, no more, back along the way you came. If you cannot find your buddy in that amount of time, just calmly make an ascent to the surface. You can really do that from almost any depth. Go to the surface, inflate your BC. BC is the buoyancy compensator we wear, sort of like the life jacket that your water safety person just mentioned. And the first thing I'm going to look for is, do I see your bubbles arising on the surface? If I do, and I may even spot those on the way up, I can follow the bubbles back down, and they'll lead me right down to you. If I don't happen to see the bubbles, if you're doing the same thing I'm doing, shortly after I arrive at the surface, you will arrive at the surface. We can figure out what went wrong and resolve either, gee, maybe the conditions aren't conducive to diving, or maybe we made a mistake and let's not do that again.
You know, I'm just sitting here thinking to myself as you're talking about scuba diving. I've never done it before, and I'm trying to think why I haven't. Sell me on it. Why is it a great sport?
Next to the birth of your first child, which you may or may not have experienced already, it's probably the most amazing thing you will ever do. I have been diving for over 35 years. I've made over 5,000 dives all over the world. I still actively teach. I will tell you that every time I even go in the pool and I am breathing underwater, there's part of our reptilian brain that is saying, I should be dying, and yet I'm not. Isn't that amazing? And I've always just had a fascination with fish and animals in the ocean. And the really cool thing about, you know, diving is, number one, when you get yourself weightless, it is as close as you will ever be able to come to flying without having a plane or a wingsuit or something like that. You get an amazing interaction with animals who are as curious about you as you are about them. And you're exploring an area of the world that roughly 8% of the population gets to see. So you get to see things and go places that a lot of people will simply never experience. So it's very relaxing. It's very zen-like. And ironically, I got involved in diving as part of a radio promotion when I was working in Richmond as a program director and disc jockey. And I used to like it because that was the one place I could go where the phones didn't ring and people didn't bother me.
How long does it take to get certified so I can go down to one of Missouri's good lakes and go for a dive sometime? How long would it take me to get there?
You can contact your local dive shop, and there are a number. I've actually visited some of the ones in the Kansas City area, and it'll vary a little bit, but generally within a couple of weekends or maybe 2 weeks, you can get certified. Now, this does not mean that you are, you know, the best diver in the world. What it means is you now have the basics to operate on safely on your own, and to continue to learn as you go along. But usually it'll involve a couple of pool sessions. There will be some academic work that you might do online or in the store, and some open water sessions. And open water simply means not in a pool. So that could be in one of your local lakes or whatever. You then get a card that certifies you to dive without the supervision, direct supervision of an instructor, and you're on your way to a lifetime of learning and a really, really cool experience.
Just a final point, Ken. Is it expensive?
It depends on how you define expensive.
Generally, I love people like you, Ken. Well, I know what expensive is, and you do too.
But generally, and it will vary from region to region. I don't know what the prices are going to be in the Kansas City area, but generally you're probably going to spend, I tell people, figure about $800 all in. That includes mask, snorkel, fins, booties, and gloves, which is considered personal gear that you would buy for yourself, and the cost of the lessons themselves. Now, once you do that, you could then decide, do I want to buy the more expensive gear, the regulators, the BCs, the wetsuits, or is that stuff I'd want to rent along the way? And depending on how often you're going to dive, that's a decision you would end up making based on how often you would do it. But the reality is, once you own your own gear, other than the cost of air fills if you dive locally or the cost of traveling if you're going to go somewhere, you've sort of got everything you need, and you can really have a great time.
Ken Curtis is the owner of Reef Seekers Dive Club out in Beverly Hills, California, and you made a great pitch there, Ken. I'm glad you did it. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. We'll look forward to seeing you underwater.
Sounds good.